This is the McKinsey Podcast, where we help you make sense out of our world's toughest business challenges.
Welcome to the show. I'm Lucia Riley.
And I'm Roberta Fassaro.
We are in a new era, and we need to behave like a new era on all fronts. It includes geopolitics, it includes this productivity acceleration, it includes the issues of the balance sheet that weren't there. Many, many new issues. And if we set our minds to solve those, we will accelerate. But we should not operate like the 70s, where we took 14 years to figure out our answers.
That's Sven Schmidt, a senior partner at McKinsey and chair of the McKinsey Global Institute. He joins me to talk about the health and wealth of the global economy and four possible futures for leaders and organizations. Three involve stagnation and stagflation, but there's one scenario, productivity acceleration, that holds some hope.
After the way everyday people are affected by the global economy, in her new book, American Made, author Farah Stockman asks the question, what happens to people when work disappears? It's an excerpt from our Author Talk series.
So Sven, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today.
It's great to be with you, Roberta.
We're talking about the health and wealth of our global economy. Sven, this research we did modeled the outlook for the global economy, specifically for inflation, interest rates, and growth for the next 10 years. And we looked at what it might mean for equity, real estate, and debt. So the research confirms that the global balance sheet grew faster than GDP. Thinking about what that means, it's sort of the difference between real wealth and paper wealth. What did that look like on the ground?
So in essence, you're totally right. We did for the first time research which added up the full balance sheet of the entire world. And in the real world, that is houses, real estate in general, it's productive capital of businesses. And then there's, of course, debt and equities that are the ownership of that. But if you look at the GDP growth of the last 20 years, and you look at the increase in real estate, you can have the material increase, which is more square meters, you can have more land, you can have more property, plant, and equipment in factories, or the prices could have gone up. And normally these moved sort of in lockstep. But the last 20 years, there was this acceleration worth 160 trillion in paper wealth in the sense that it was only done by prices. Now, what it does say is that these assets are scarce. We know this in the housing market. Many people would want a nicer, bigger house, and there's not enough available. Now, the question whether the paper wealth will stay there will also be whether the shortage continues, because it could actually very well be continuing to be a store of value. If the housing shortage doesn't continue and some other factors are at play, then you know you could have the paper wealth evaporate.
You've given us an example in the housing market. Are there other broader implications? Why do business leaders need to care about this mismatch or this gap?
Well, the first point is we often just look at the P&L when we look at the aggregate economy. We actually don't look at the balance sheet. And the balance sheet has very profound implications because if it turns out to be paper wealth, that wealth goes down. You could have large mismatches between the debt that was used to finance and needs to be paid with higher interest rates and the wealth that you still have for what you purchased, real estate or assets before. Starting to look at the world that way is very, very important now because we are living in a time with higher interest rates. We live in a time with higher inflation. And so we want to pay attention to the balance sheet because that's where the stock of value sits. No, GDP is about 100 trillion for the world. Our balance sheet is north of 500 trillion. So there's more stock than flow. And so if the stock moves around 20%, that's amount the same amount as the global GDP. And so a small variation on the balance sheet is actually a large variation in the real economy because that stock of value is the wealth of people, the wealth of businesses, and their sense of whether they can still spend. In a way, real estate is savings for people.
A lot of the analysis focuses on the United States, and I'm curious why that is and whether these findings are applicable globally.
The findings are absolutely applicable globally, and we have done many more countries. The United States, in general, has more data. It's a large market, more uniform, but in general, it even then has more data. We are continuously working to get the other markets at more depth, but the lessons are totally applicable to everybody else.
Sven, you and the team reviewed economic health and wealth in the U.S. And elsewhere through these four scenarios. Three portend stagnation, stagflation, and then one projects what we call productivity acceleration. I want to take a closer look at the four. The first that we talk about is a return to a past era scenario. Yeah. What would that look like on the ground?
Well, basically, if you want to call that era, it was the last 30 years, the global era of markets, of globalization, no geopolitics, low interest rates, low inflation, and all that kind of stuff, and a continued shortage of assets, which would mean that as GDP grows, you would sort of make that gap of paper wealth or real wealth bigger. So basically, we go back to what we were used to the last 10, 20 years.
Right. So it'd be more of the same, that sort of the do-nothing scenario in a way. Yeah.
We're not in more of the same right now, just to be clear. But this would be the return to more of the same.
Okay. And how does that compare with the next scenario, the higher for longer scenario? Tell us more about that.
So that would be a persistently high inflation and interest rates where growth slows, resembling the 70s oil shock in the U.S. economy, but also in Europe, essentially for two decades. Inflation was at 5 and interest rates were north of 5. And in that scenario, you get a risk of equities going down, of debt being stressed, a lot of restructuring going on, emerging market debt crisis, and so on. Because basically the balance sheet is not funded by a consistent level of growth. And while at the same time, you have inflationary and interest rate pressures on the price of capital.
For some of our younger listeners who don't remember the 1970s oil shocks, what did that actually look like on the ground?
Well, I was a boy, 7 years old, and I was roller skating on the highways of my country because all parents were not allowed to drive on Sundays to conserve oil. And it was the oil shortage, not so much the real estate shortage, that drove the prices up into inflationary territory. It was also the time of the peak Cold War and many other factors. I will say I had a blissful youth and didn't notice much of it. But at that time, house prices went down in some markets by 20 and other by 40. Equities went down over a longer period by 20 and 40, which is very consistent with what's modeled here over these longer periods of time. For some reason, as a kid, you could have a good life. But my parents, they were basically shielding it from me.
Right. I remember long lines at the gas pumps, but I was not driving, right? I was not driving.
Long line at the gas pumps is the same thing, yeah.
Later on, I want to hear more about the roller skating. And if you're still roller skating.
It's rollerblading now.
Yes. We've changed. The technology's changed. The third scenario, Sven, that I wanted to get to was seemingly the worst case scenario, right? The balance sheet reset. What would the economy look like under that scenario?
So the mimicking event was what happened in Japan in the real estate crisis. Arguably, that was a wider paper wealth gap at that time than we have now aggregate to the world. But basically, what this model says is the balance sheet will be adjusted relatively fast, which means quite fast drops in asset prices for real estate, property, plant, and equipment, and so on. And call it with that, then equities will be next because they will reprice to growth. And it's a drawn-out deleveraging and sharp contraction of the asset prices and so on.
How did businesses experience that in Japan? What happened?
That feels crisis-like. Mm-hmm. That's restructuring, readjusting costs, resetting balance sheets, taking the bubbles out. That puts pressure on the labor market. That might not mean wage increases. And I would say the first round of that is pretty tough. Of course, in any crisis, after the first round, there's a way back up, but you come from a quite deep point. And that people felt in their ordinary lives.
Productivity acceleration seems to be by far the most desirable outcome. What is the most simple and straightforward definition of productivity acceleration?
So with productivity, we basically measure how much we can get done as an individual in terms of output per hour, output per year, as a GDP per capita sense. And usually this has grown by 1 or 2% per year. Basically, for the same amount of hours worked, we could get 1 or 2% more output. That happened because of technology, digitization, but in the past it was more energy consumption, it was tools and learning. And the expectation about the future of work is 50% of tasks can be automated with available technology. And we basically could double output with the same number of people because of productivity. And we would maybe take 20 years to do so. And that would support a lot of growth. Yeah? And then that growth will be not inflationary growth. It will be real growth because it's output. And that would start to suppress inflation. It would also then suppress the interest rates. And the output, of course, will feel to all people as being more prosperous, either through services or products. And in a way, all the predicaments that we have now, the predicaments of aging that lead to inflation, the predicaments of the energy transition, which is inflationary, the predicaments of having to diversify supply chains, which is inflationary, as well as the predicament of having to spend more on defense in these uncertain times, which again is inflationary, all of that would be helped if we could get more done with less time, or with the same time, we can get double the outcome. And so productivity will have to be the solution. The interesting part is that the technology for the productivity exists. The question is whether we will have the human transformation speed to get it done.
The report says that accelerating productivity is elusive in advanced economies. I'm just curious about that. Why is that so?
All right. This will be the toughest question of the day, because basically productivity growth has decelerated for the past decades in the Western world. While, of course, developing market growth was partially driven by increased productivity in China, Africa, India, LATAM, and so on. But we have had a deceleration. This has been studied a million times, and I don't think there's a good answer. Different things have been discussed. One is, do we actually measure output in the right way when we measure stuff we own and the prices? Are we, for example, really reflecting the fact that through technology, we can do so much more? Did we account for the technology acceleration in the right way? That's one question. The second one is, are the humans catching up to the technology? Or, like everybody predicted when we had automatic teller machines, that we would not have tellers at the bank. True, we don't have tellers at the bank, but we have advisors at the bank. And actually, the number of people are roughly still the same. And so what happens is, when something goes down, something else comes up, and the new thing might be less productive than the old. So you gain productivity on one side, but you got something less productive back. I believe there is this possibility of productivity acceleration in the future, because we are now digital and we can now automate.
Right. I know in this report and other McKinsey research, McKinsey's taking a hard look at productivity under times of uncertainty. So where should productivity come from now, or where is it coming from now?
Well, I think the biggest one is technology related, and it's all forms of automation. Some algorithm does it, some tool does it. It can be a robot, can be a scanner, can be something. But automation should be one of the bigger things that will happen. Of course, there's always learning of people getting more productive, which is human capital. You know, the better the skill of the people, the better they can connect to the productivity. But there's a third factor that is underestimated, is the ability of organizations to change at pace, which is actually almost independent from skilling and technology. It's how fast are you adopting? In many companies, you first pilot in one corner, then you scale in one use case, and then the next, and then the next. And as a result, you're taking 2-3 years to get started. What if everybody on every new wave starts at scale at the same time? I think there's lots of inertia lessons that we need to break through. There might also be some stuff on regulation that is in our way of doing fast transformation to high productivity. But we will have to crack this problem. We are in a new era. And we need to behave like a new era on all fronts. It includes geopolitics, it includes this productivity acceleration, it includes the issues of the balance sheet that weren't there. Many, many new issues. And if we set our minds to solve those, we will accelerate. But we should not operate like the 70s, where we took 14 years to figure out our answers.
You mentioned regulation. What role can policymakers play in accelerating productivity?
Labor market reforms will help here. Policies that stimulate reskilling would also help.
Given the dynamics that we've highlighted around paper versus real wealth, real outcomes, what's the play for financial companies, for banks? How will they need to change in this environment?
I think the biggest one is to not assume that the future is the same as the past. You actually have to understand whether your company, your bank, your insurance company can sustain these scenarios, can actually thrive in these scenarios, and how you can early detect which one you're in and whether you're navigating in the right way. This probably will include having to change your business models in certain places to get the risk and return balance in the right place. That's why we found it so important to talk about the balance sheet, because the swing of the balance sheet is so big. And your question on financial institutions is very right, because they cover the entire balance sheet as financial intermediators. And so this stuff will go through them in a big way.
How should investors think about, should they be looking at investment decisions differently?
Yeah, they need to look where the balance sheet risk is. They've been modeling earnings per share and all that kind of stuff, but different companies will now be exposed differently to the global balance sheet. Some will be okay in all four scenarios, maybe with more or less growth. Some will be actually prone to get big balance sheet hits or benefits, but the balance sheet will swing. Not all companies have the same balance sheet structure, but if you have balance sheet events in the economy, you want to know whether you're investing against the world's balance sheet.
In this case, are we suggesting that executives look at all four of these scenarios, or do we have a perspective on how likely one scenario is to emerge over another?
I think they should look at all four, and then in addition, do something else. Inside macro scenarios, there will be lots of events, a certain regulation, a certain war, a certain this, a certain that. In every country, there could be a regulation. In every country, a competitor could do something. In every place, something else could happen. Your customers, by the way, can be affected by all these events as well.
Is this the CEO's job to look at? Like, who's involved with looking at these scenarios and making decisions?
This is the CEO, the board, the top management team. Mm-hmm. This is not a side job. I mean, people are changing their supply chains. They're changing their business models. They change their investment stance. They change their debt structures. They change, you know, so these things are just too big to presume, you know, you can solve this at the microcell level.
That leads me to kind of a broader question. So we all want to accelerate productivity. That seems to be the best scenario. But how can companies prepare for the less favorable ones?
So one thing that is consistent with this paper is look at your balance sheet. Where are the assets? How are they financed? What is the implications of high interest rates, lower equity returns? Then you can look at your business model to figure out a better profitability situation and look at the flows. But the scenarios, these things are not continuous. We will shift from one to the other, probably in a relatively swift moment. It could be 1 year from now, it could be in 4 years from now, but we will be in one of these places. Since the balance sheet is so big, a shift from one to the other scenario will very quickly bite the balance sheet and take large events through your P&L. And so I would spend more time on the balance sheet, in addition, of course, to all the work on business model and P&L. It's crucial in these times.
Looking at the four scenarios requires taking this long-term view. And I know that sometimes it can be hard for executives to get into that mindset around long-termism versus short-termism. Do you have a perspective on why it's so hard and why people do need to start to take this long-term view?
I might surprise you now. I actually don't believe this short-term, long-term issue is a big issue.
Interesting.
It might be at some individual's level.
Sure.
But we've had companies that had zero profits that had very high value for a long time. So it's not the market that can't see a unique future against a very different future of today. We've seen companies make very large investments against the quarter and be successful and be valued. So it's not the market. I actually think the market might be less short-term. There are elements of the market are short-term, but the market can credit long-term bets and has done so in the past. Having talked to many, many leaders around the world, there's way more long-term thinking right now because it's more needed.
Right.
So I already see it being internalized, but it's new and the topics are complex. And in that is where people are still struggling.
Thank you for making that distinction between the kind of individual view, right? Short-term, long-termism versus market view, because that's really helpful. So Sven, what surprised you most about the research?
At the beginning of this work, we thought this is sort of for the institutionals, the World Bank, the IMF, and so on. And I would say the first people that looked at it in a very serious way were those people. But now that we put these scenarios together, make it more concrete and show, you know, the balance sheet could trigger scenarios in which equities are not going to go up. That's a very serious message for everybody who's participating in the economy and the market. And so it's broadening, and it is because everybody needs to look at their balance sheet, because the balance sheet swings can bite you and accelerate you in surprising ways.
Let me just say, Sven, this has been a great conversation. For someone whose head is not immersed in all the details of the global balance sheet, this has just been really educational. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you, Brett. It was good to talk about this topic. It's not an easy one, but it's fundamental.
Companies large and small are affected by balance sheet swings, as are the people who work for them. Here's Ferris Stockman to talk about her new book, American Made, and our disconnect from the working class.
We talk a lot about the white working class. The working class is not white. It is very diverse. It's a disservice to working class people not to truly see that. For blue collar people, the civil rights movement and the women's rights movement had so much to do with jobs. Literally, they boiled down in many cases to one thing, which is, are you allowed to operate a machine on the factory floor? The labor movement made those jobs middle-class jobs. So what was the civil rights movement but the fight for those jobs? Of course, within 15 years after the Civil Rights Act passed, factories start moving away. First to the American South, where there's no labor unions, and then overseas. So we'll never know what racial disparities would look like today if those factories had remained. I feel like in some educated quarters, there is a way that we talk about the working class and laid off factory workers as if they're just a bunch of privileged, whiny white men who need to get over it. We don't look at the fact that in the 70s, many of them were forced to share their jobs with blacks and with women. They didn't want to do it, but they did it. Guess who didn't share their jobs? The corporate boards that today, they look an awful lot like they did back in the 60s. And so in a lot of ways, race is used as a way to dismiss these economic grievances of a whole class of people. The conversation that we have in educated circles about white privilege is really important, but oftentimes it pretends that the laid off white factory worker has the same amount of privilege as the white CEO. I looked at how many women are working in manufacturing. It's something like 3 million American women work in manufacturing, far more than work as lawyers, and yet their needs are almost invisible. But if you were to go to them and talk about women's issues and what they would be looking for, they're looking for childcare. They're looking for the ability to have a baby and take paid leave. A lot of the women's issues that I read about, how do we negotiate salaries like a man? A woman in a factory like that doesn't have to negotiate salaries like a man. They don't negotiate their salaries. The union has salaries that are, you know, everybody who is this machine operator and this years of seniority is going to get this. We don't understand their lives very well. That's one of the reasons it's so hard to communicate about their needs and about what we can do for them. The most shocking thing I learned through this process is that only a third of American adults have a four-year college degree. Almost every decision of significance is made by people with advanced degrees, and yet we are a tiny slice of the country. We have the power to make these decisions, and yet our economic reality is vastly different than the people who have to live with our decisions. The disconnect culturally, geographically, became so clear. We have to rebuild our ties to working people. If we want to represent them and keep making these decisions and running the country, we have to make it work for them. We have to make globalization work for them.
Thanks so much for listening to the McKinsey Podcast. I'm Lucia Raheli.
And I'm Roberta Fasaro.
Find us on McKinsey.com. We'll have a transcript of this episode up shortly.
And check out the McKinsey Insights app, where you can find this podcast and other helpful content updated daily.
And if you would, we'd love for you to leave a rating and a review.
We'll see you in 2 weeks.